not going to be able to not give air support to us when we get on the beach. So,
pretty wide ranging. Again, he went over to give an award named after a CIA guy who tried to blow the whistle on the Vietnam War back in that era. The Truman op-ed is available, Limit CIA Role to Intelligence, and it was published 50 years ago tomorrow. Maybe Ray McGovern on his website, raymcgovern.com, will actually write that article. I guess I'll ask him to do that. Anyway, it's time for me to go. It's time for the Labor Hour. Time to support community media, particularly this one right here, WEFT, Champaign-Urbana. If you haven't done that lately, maybe you can just mediate that on the website. I think it is possible to donate that way. There's still a payroll deduction is available. The push for it has passed, but you can still, if you're working for a bigger enterprise, many of them have the community shares, and it is really important. The Labor Hour coming up with a media activist in Decatur, Illinois, kind of a site for a lot of labor struggles through the decades. Time for me to go. Thanks for listening. WEFT Champaign-Urbana, where the opinions you hear are those of the people cited and the people speaking them.
to another edition of the World Labor Hour, brought to you in the air by listener-supported community radio station WEFT, broadcast 90.1 FM and webcast live worldwide at weft.org. The views and opinions expressed here are those of speakers and do not necessarily represent those of the station manager, board of directors, or of Prairie Air Incorporated. Now here's Bob with some of our underwriting announcements.
The Graduate Employees Organization Union, GEO, at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign strives to not only democratically represent graduate employees, but also to give solidarity and support to other unions, organizations, and workers engaged in the struggle for social justice, both on and off campus. The GEO is proud to support the World Labor Hour on WEFT Community Radio. And programming on the World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and by the Illinois Education Association Union. The Illinois Education Association's mission is to effect excellence and equity in public education and to be the advocacy organization for all public education employees. And the World Labor Hour is supported in part by listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois.
Okay, thank you, Bob. And we got, some news stories here that I guess we could go into. And let's let everyone know that we have a special guest that we'll announce here. We're going to keep it secret for a moment. But anyway.
It's Phil Robertson.
Oh, who's that?
Duck Dynasty.
Oh, see, I don't watch corporate television programs, so I'm kind of a little
I tried
bit...
to watch that show once.
Yeah.
It was just, it's like... totally scripted,
yeah,
and done by non-actors, the people who just cannot act, period. It's all of those shows are ridiculous like that. I kind of like Pawn Stars, though, just because of the cool stuff they have.
Yeah.
The acting.
Okay, I guess I'll start off here with a story from Korea. The South Korean rail strike by members of the rail union, the KRWU, is entering its ninth day, and a massive police presence is confronting the strikers. We should remember that the U.S. government has a powerful influence in the action of its South Korean proxy. Like here in the U.S., Korea is in a privatization binge. It's worth remembering the South Korean military, for example, is under the command of the U.S. military. Police raided the offices of the Korea Railroad Corporation's labor union in Seoul on Tuesday morning, taking away documents and computer hard drive. Hundreds of police officers lined up on the street outside to quell any possible unrest. Authorities also tried to enforce arrest warrants that were issued on Monday for 10 union members, but they were blocked by crowds of union members from gaining access to them. Government's response to organized labor is the toughest ever seen in Korea, with 8,565 Korea rail workers currently suspended. Anyway, the Korean Railroad Workers Union strike against privatization this is really strange written news story. It must be from a Google translation or something. But anyway, these were the largest such numbers in the history of the South Korean rail strike. One of the suspended workers was Lee Ki-dam, an engineer with more than 23 years service. Lee runs the Taibak Central Line, which runs through some of the country's most remote mountainous areas in Gangwon Province. What he can't figure out is the government's response to the strike. He goes, "I was fired over a strike in 1994 and reinstated 10 years later. Even then, there was ongoing communication about railway development plans and issues involving dismissed workers through the government and the union or through civic groups and the tripartite commission among union management and government. Once the Lee Myung-bak administration came to office in 2008, all dialogue stopped. They refused to recognize us." So we'll keep you updated on that story.
All right. Also, another part of the world. On the heels of Brazil-wide protest, the aerospace strikers win a pay raise. Some 2 million people participated in demonstrations all over Brazil in June and won lowered bus fares. And it says here, imagine if a union meeting was held in front of your workplace right before work. Perfectly legal under American law. Let's say 70% participated and you all decided to go in 5 minutes late. Must have started something like this in Brazil years ago. Now unions call plant gate meetings, and at starting time, most workers don't go in. They go in when the meeting is over, and no discipline happens to anyone. If negotiations are going on and going badly, a vote may be taken not to go in at all that day. So this has happened in São José dos Campos, which is an hour east of São Paulo, which is home to Embraer, the third largest aerospace company in the world, and to a GM plant with 6,000 workers. The union at the plants there, CPS Canlutas, represents metal workers in the region and was attempting to negotiate a pattern contract for these workers as it has in the past. The goal was an 8% raise. 6% of that is to make up for inflation, and they negotiate every year there. GM had settled, but Embraer, with 13,000 aerospace workers, was a holdout. At a workers' assembly, they voted to strike for 4 hours. The company still refused to bargain. The following week, they struck for 24 hours. After another vote at a plant gate meeting, still nothing changed, so the union went to court. The court said the company should negotiate because all the other main companies had settled for the 8%. This decision, however, is not binding, and Embraer continued to refuse to come to the table. A workers' assembly voted to strike again for 24 hours. This time, participation was 90%, better than in any strike in 20 years. Finally, Embraer gave in, and the workers voted to accept the offer of 8%. These folks in Brazil now are in solidarity with the folks out there in Seattle that are working for the union in Boeing and stuff like that. So,
oh, okay. You
know, they've actually had visitors from some of the machinist union in Kansas go down there and stuff. So, anyway, interesting how things go in Brazil there. They just have their meetings right at the plant gate like that. They may not go to work that day.
You know? I heard that's what they do in France as well. And yeah. I don't know about any of the other European countries, but I think it's a European tradition going back to the early 20th century. And I think it's a good system, frankly.
Yeah.
Another story from another place in the world. Hundreds of workers at Amazon in Germany have walked off the job in an effort to put pressure on the American online retailer in the busy days before Christmas to settle on a new wage agreement. The Verdi Union said on Monday that several hundred workers were staging one-day warning strikes at Amazon logistics centers in Leipzig, Bad Hersfeld, and Graben. Verdi says German workers will also picket with American colleagues outside the Amazon headquarters in Seattle to press their demands. The union says Amazon workers receive lower wages than others in retail and mail order jobs in Germany. Amazon says its distribution warehouses in Germany are logistics centers, and employees are already paid on the upper end of what workers in that industry earn. Amazon has about 9,000 full-time employees in Germany.
Hey, Dave, I'll bring something up on that.
Yes.
I remember, I think it was last year, and people can probably find this somehow on the internet. I can't remember. It might have been Nation Magazine. There was an article by somebody who spent some time working, I believe it was Amazon or a similar situation, in one of their warehouses, and it was just awful. Yeah. I mean, it was a lot worse than I would imagine working in a warehouse like that.
Yeah, no air conditioning in the summertime, no heat in the wintertime and stuff, long hours. You know, I mean, they had to go on strike to just get knee pads or something like that to grab stuff off the bottom shelves and things, you know. I mean, long hours and just a really rapid pace. They keep those people moving.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a lot of those workers end up working through their lunch hour just so that they can make their quota of
picks
that's
or ridiculous.
Something like that.
So, yes. Yeah. Have you guys heard about what Amazon wants to do in the near future is basically use drones to deliver products?
Yeah. That was on 60 Minutes a couple of weeks ago.
I mean, this is mind-boggling.
Yeah,
I mean,
what could go wrong?
Oh, well, yeah, I can just imagine all these drones flying all over the place. And frankly, I could see people, taking shotguns and shooting some of them down to get the products. Or not so much that, maybe, but just the fact that you can imagine if that expanded, what an annoyance that would be, or not to mention a safety hazard.
Oh, yeah. Well, they're developing all these cars that can drive themselves, so I assume that they could do it with trucks, but then they can put a conveyor in the back, and it can just like sort of plop it out like it's taking a dump in your yard and move on.
Okay. Well, the way I understood it was they're going to have small little flying drones at some point.
Oh, yeah, I know. That was another idea I had. This might be a little safer.
You think?
Easier to deal with.
I don't know about that. God, can you imagine all these drones flying all over the place?
That's what I mean. I was talking about a ground vehicle.
You're talking about ground vehicles, yeah.
Automated.
Right. Okay, we're going to take a quick music break here, and then we'll be right back. You're listening to the World Labor Hour on listener-supported community radio station WFT in Champaign, Illinois. Stay tuned.
Come all you good workers, good news to you I'll tell, of how the good old Union has come in here to dwell. Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on?
One law for the rulers and one law for the ruled. That's wow, that's a great statement. Okay, Bob, you want to finish the underwriting announcements here real quick?
Sure. This hour of programming is brought to you in part by Central Illinois Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Central Illinois Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month. For more information or for the unemployed and underemployed helpline, give them a call at 217-328-2295. And also, programming on the World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and by Decatur attorney Bill Faber, who believes that the mission of the law is the safety of the people. Bill Faber proudly supports the World Labor Hour.
Well, just by chance, Bill Faber is live in the studio with us today. Bill, welcome to the World Labor Hour. I should say welcome back. You were on before. Yeah.
Thanks, yeah. David, Bob, welcome. And Bill. Great to be here.
Yeah, welcome, Bill.
Okay, can you read that last part of the underwriting statement, Bob?
The mission of the law is the safety of the people.
Okay, let's start with that. When you sort of picked that for your underwriting announcement, what did you have in mind, basically? I mean, is this just elaborate, if you would, on that.
Well, you know, our American law really stems back from the great Roman law.
Mm-hmm.
And the orator Cicero, when he was in charge, he had a saying about the people of Rome, and he said that the safety of the people was the highest law. And I think that just equates into the work that we have to do as lawyers and as judges and as a democracy. That if that is first, you get a lot of your priorities straight.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, that's fascinating because, most... The law I'm familiar with stems from, the U.S. Constitution and before that the Magna Carta, and this goes back even farther. Wow,
sure,
that's impressive.
We just concluded a jury trial last week where a lady was going through a construction site that remained open to the public. Mm-hmm. It was an excavated area. There was a walkway that was raised. The business was open at night. There was no lights. The work crew had left, and she was trying to negotiate this 50-foot long path at night with no lights, and she fell off of the side as the pathway gave way, and she shattered her lower leg. And all it would take, mm-hmm. according to this construction safety engineer, was a handrail that would have cost $150.
Oh, wow.
And so she had $60,000 of bills and an unnecessary injury and affected her whole life.
Okay. Yeah, and people always getting upset about government regulations for having a handrail like going up to your steps at your own house, too. But it's for your own good.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Bill. Is this sort of typical cases that you normally do in the course of a year? I know you're one of the few attorneys in Illinois that do lead paint poisoning cases and stuff.
Yeah, Decatur is a high risk lead zone. Our kids are really exposed to lead over in Decatur because so much of our housing stock was built before 1960.
Okay. Okay.
Oh, by the way, that's laborers' work, and we have classes for people to get licenses to do that.
Okay.
In fact, a friend of mine, he went to a private class once and got his license. And they gave him a book on places where to look for jobs. And every place he called said, well, we just call the local laborers hall.
Oh, okay.
So he, like, wasted a bunch of money on that.
Okay. Yeah, well, I'm glad to hear the laborers are, you know.
Really, man, if you may get them a bunch of work. Replace that stuff.
Yes.
Okay. Well, so, you know, kind of this is a general theme. I invited you to come on the show today to talk sort of about some issues, or legal issues, I should say, that working people will typically encounter during the court. Well, if they're unfortunate or whatever. Could you just talk a little bit about some of these issues that, you know, working people out there need to be aware of?
Well, as you know, David, the ubiquitous issue we run into is insurance.
Mm-hmm.
But right now, an issue paramount in our community is, it's almost like a bubonic plague, is mortgage foreclosure.
Mortgage foreclosure, yes.
We have, I don't know how many, I would gather to say maybe 50% of the homes in Decatur are underwater.
50%?
Meaning more is owed on the house than they're worth. And so there's families that are just struggling. And a couple of weeks ago, my wife and I were walking our old neighborhood. And we were passing the home that we had first bought together.
Mm-hmm.
And we were looking forward to, you know, thinking about it idyllically. And we turned the corner and walked up to it. There were posters plastered all over the windows and the door.
Oh,
it had been vacant, and it was obviously in foreclosure. It just broke our hearts.
Yeah. So how, as an attorney, I mean, what is it that you can do about this, you know, with somebody's facing foreclosure?
You know, David, when the court call is made in the foreclosure courtrooms, 90% of the folks never show up for the court call. So the most important thing that a homeowner can do is to fight it and show up, because the paperwork that the banks present to the judge are usually wrong.
Wow.
And so there's some technicalities that can be presented because the banks love technicalities, so why not use them against them?
Yeah.
So
love that.
So the word is to show up.
Mm-hmm.
Show up and fight it, deny the complaint, make them prove the amount, because often the amount they claim you owe is wrong.
Oh, okay. All right. Now, I heard, too, this was a couple years ago. I think we had this story on the Labor Hour then about when, you know, after the 2008 financial crisis hit and foreclosures started skyrocketing, where a judge, I think it was Cleveland, ruled that he wasn't going to proceed with the case against the homeowner being foreclosed on because the banks couldn't find who the rightful owner of the mortgage was.
They had no paperwork. They had no titles for the home and everything.
Right.
They had gone through all those collateralized debt obligations like that, CDOs, and they were just buying humongous tracts of, you know, mortgages, and they really had no individual paperwork for any of that. So the judge finally said, you know, those are invalid.
Well, it takes a courageous judge.
Yes.
I would have to say that many of our fine judges may not exhibit that courage.
Well, I was reading about Florida, which I guess this is just pandemic there. And basically, the article I was reading, it's a rubber stamp process.
Yeah.
You know, people don't even get representation.
Sure. Mm. Well, for example, the foreclosure statute in Illinois was written by bank lawyers.
Oh.
And so here's the deal. There's a overriding principle in American jurisprudence, and that is to get into court, you have to show the judge you've got standing. Standing is like a passport. If you wanted to fly to Germany or something, you can't get into Germany without a passport. Well, in American law, unless you can show standing, you don't get into court, but not in foreclosure cases. All you got to do is say, Judge, we got standing. You don't even need to prove it. And so and they may not have standing. You might have years of litigation and then find out that the person or the bank that's bringing the case is the wrong bank. Because as you said, Bob, they don't have the paperwork to prove they've got standing. So that's how we handle foreclosures for American families here in Illinois.
Okay. Yeah, so
here's something.
Go ahead, Bill.
A little factoid.
Yeah.
Macon County is number 34 in rank in terms of income per capita per household in Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
Champaign is 35.
Okay.
So actually, the statistics, and Piatt County is actually where I live, is 18.
Oh, wow.
And see, and a lot of people think Champaign's some kind of rich town.
Mm-hmm.
But consistently, I remember, I really researched this a lot more in the 80s,
mm-hmm.
but consistently, Peoria and Decatur have had higher incomes per capita than Champaign.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people say it's because of the university here.
Mm-hmm. But, Bill, you know, when I was over visiting you on your television show a couple of months ago, you threw some statistics at me from Decatur, particularly Macon County in general, that I just found mind-blowing.
Well, we have the highest unemployment rate in
Illinois. But yet the 34th highest income? Per capita, that is, though, per capita.
Yes. Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we just had some big news over in Decatur. Maybe you guys aren't following it that closely, but you know, ADM is moving its world headquarters from Decatur to Chicago and bringing about 100 of the top paying jobs in our community to Chicago. But before they made that move, they had made promises to our community to support the school district, to support the local charities. Mm-hmm. But that was contingent, they said, on getting the state support and subsidies. And, of course, so those were denied them, and now ADM is reneging on its commitment to our community.
Okay, now when I first heard about this case, I thought it was about that they wanted state money not to move, but they're going to move anyway, and it was just a matter of,
are going to move anyway. But, you know, they're a big player in our local charities and our school districts, and a lot of people rely on their largesse, and I guess it's kind of like the guy who has the ball. He didn't like the way the rules were played, so he's going to take his ball and go home.
Yeah, well, here's something. There used to be that General Cable plant there in Monticello, and I'm constantly like going into some store, and I'll strike up a conversation with the clerk working there, and a lot of times, I used to work there. It was a pretty good job compared to this. Mm-hmm. It's like hardly, unless they got into the building trades or something, hardly anybody got a job anywhere close to as good as what they had at Cable, the IBEW.
Yeah, I mean, of course, as a lot of our listeners may not know, that Decatur used to be a very vibrant industrial city. I mean, it was, all sorts of good-paying union jobs, and it wasn't just like ADM and Staley and Firestone and Caterpillar.
Mueller.
Yeah, there was all these other smaller firms that, machine shops, what have you, that got work from, but this is, starting in, the late 70s, plants started closing, and the ones that are still there had cutbacks, and then there was labor strife in the early mid-90s with the strikes at Caterpillar, Staley, and Firestone, and it's just, and a similar thing happened
to BorgWarner.
BorgWarner.
Yeah, I was there back in 2008. Staging for the pipeline at BorgWarner. Now there's a few iron workers have a little prefab shop in there. They rent part of it.
And now I understand that people that do have good paying jobs, decent paying jobs, I should say, are required to work very long hours, rotating shifts and stuff. In fact, Bill, I think you said you had a friend or two that was in that situation.
Yes, yes. We got some ladies who are working 12-hour shifts 3 days a week, and it's just beating them up. You know, when I think about Decatur, where I live, because my work allows me to have interaction with working families, and I see what they're going through. I think about Detroit, and now Detroit's a long way away and a big story away, but I just see shadows of Detroit being cast on my town of Decatur as an industrial base. I drive around our community, and it looks like Beirut with all the empty buildings, the vacant properties, and this is supposed to be America. Is this what we call success? Looks like something's not going right.
Well, I was shocked working in Danville in recent years. On the east side of Danville, I mean, it's all there is old liquor stores with hand-painted, brush-painted signs, you know, like, it's just, But there are, you know, some nice places. I mean, there's something I really like about Decatur, and it's that one kind of historic neighborhood just west of downtown where they have all those Victorian houses. I mean, that demonstrates what developed in that town. And I remember the downtown since I was a kid, man, and just all it was, Decatur just it reminded it was like the city of broad shoulders. You know, it just reminded me so much of the industrial 40s and 50s era, man, of those buildings.
Sure.
Champaign looks like a cow town. Shoot westerns here or something.
But you know, Bill, that's a good point about Detroit, because what's really disturbing about Detroit is the what's happened recently, where the governor has appointed a city manager, eliminated by a stroke of a pen the elected mayor and city council, and now they're talking about thinking about selling selling off Diego Rivera mirrors that have been in some building in downtown Detroit, you know, to get money for corporate creditors, basically. But at the same time, there's all these hedge funds buying up blocks after blocks of vacant lots.
Yeah, I just wanted to bring up, most of our listeners probably realize this, but Diego Rivera was a I'm not sure if he's a member of the party.
Well, he's left-wing anyway.
He's definitely a radical left-wing artist from, what era, 20s to 30s. 50s.
Yeah, 20s maybe. To 50s, yeah.
And he was associated also with Frida Kahlo.
Yeah.
Or Kahlo.
Kahlo, yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, David, the private equity firms are buying up property in our community, too.
That was going to be my next question, yes.
You know, and they're getting real bargains, and they're going in there, and they're rehabbing them, and they're going to, you know, rents, and the rents are going to go up as people can't afford housing. Mm-hmm. But here in our town, we have our city council, mm-hmm. and all they do is, because they're dealing with a tight budget, mm-hmm. and they have their eyes on the pensions. The city workers' pension.
Oh,
I mean, they
yes.
are just, all they call this pension is what's killing us. And now corporate America has found a way to take away pensions and how to take away democracy by having a city manager appointed for Detroit and disenfranchising 650,000 citizens.
Boy, you talk about corporate feudalism.
There you go.
So I don't know what else to call it, but that's what it is.
They
I
have mean, found infection. A way. Here's yes. what a brave judge would have done in that bankruptcy ruling.
Mm-hmm.
When the petition was brought to declare Detroit bankruptcy, he would have said no.
Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed. Okay, we're going to take another quick music break, and we'll be right back. You're listening to World Labor Hour and WFT, listener-supported community station, broadcasting from Champaign, Illinois. Stay tuned.
City streets across the world, and every bell in the city's rung, every freedom song that's yet unsung. We'll find a voice, we'll find a way to fill the air on the 1st of May. And in the storm we'll bend like the willow yield, but together we will stand the wall against the wind. Soul who's perished along freedom's road, at the barricade or in the jail cell. To struggle hard is to struggle well. Your struggle is alive today. We're marching out on the 1st of May, and in the storm we'll bend like the willow gear, but together we will stand a wall against the whispers in the migrant field, clenched fists, and in the prison yard, there's a rumor that there's something they might have missed. In every mill and mine and shop, every baton swing of every crooked cop, every dirty threat, every boss's curse, keep your mouth shut, keep your eyes on your work. I'll take my chances, today's the day. The clock ticks down till the 1st of May. Storm will bend like the willow will give, but together we will stand a wall against the wind. And in the storm will bend like the willow will give, but together we will stand, my friend, a wall against the wind, 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 a wall against the wind.
Okay, that was Tom Morello, Stand Against the Wind, and we're back with Decatur attorney Bill Faber. Bill, some other issues that will affect working people a lot during the music break you mentioned was dealing with insurance. Can you talk a little about that?
Yeah, you know, David, insurance is just ubiquitous in our lives today. I mean, we can't do insurance for our homes, for the road, for mm-hmm. medical, et cetera. But here's a couple of things that the average working guy and gal should think about. Let's talk about car insurance.
Okay.
First of all, where to get it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you go online and buy insurance, you might get a better rate than you might from your local agent.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, when you have a problem, when you have an issue, and you want to deal with that complicated situation online, good luck.
So, yeah, man, geckos won't help you.
That's right. So my advice is to develop a relationship with a local agent. Go talk to a few. See who you like and mm-hmm. make sure that they take care of you and have a relationship. So if that bad thing happens, you've got someone you can turn to and you can find.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be my first tip.
Yeah, by the way, my insurance agent is named Bill also. He's somebody that's lived in B-Med. I've known him my whole life. And he formerly worked at Kraft Foods, but when his dad died, he took over the insurance company.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, he was a line worker at Kraft Foods, mm-hmm. too. And it's really great to be able to just go in there and talk to the guy, describe what you need, and get it done.
Mm-hmm.
And you're supporting a local family, right?
Mm-hmm.
That your money kind of stays in town. His money stays in town. He's part of the community. And,
right.
you know, it all goes around.
His son works there, mm-hmm. you know?
Yes.
Yeah. It's a good thing.
Right. The other thing is, you know, if you get into an accident on the road, make sure you report it to your insurance company. But the other thing is, get in touch with a lawyer.
Okay.
Even if you think it's a minor matter, don't hope for the best. Get a hold of that lawyer because there may be things he can do for you or advice or gather evidence that may be critical. So really, most of the folks we work with are fair and good-hearted people and think the other people are going to be fair. The other insurance company is going to be fair. Good luck with that.
Has laws changed in Illinois over the years as far as the Department of Insurance and, just the laws in general?
No, they're pretty basically the same.
Mm-hmm.
The Department of Insurance is run for the insurance companies by the insurance companies.
Really?
And have never closed down an insurance company with a direct action. So people think they can make a complaint to the Illinois Department of Insurance. What a waste of time that is.
Wow, so it's another case of the corporations writing the laws for their industries, more or less, and appointing the people they want to run the regulatory agency.
Absolutely.
Yeah, they have like a revolving door situation there, possibly. And you know something's interesting, too, is a lot of federal agencies, like the Department of Agriculture,
mm-hmm.
or the Food and Drug Administration, too, they have two missions. One mission is to promote the industry,
mm-hmm.
and the other mission is to regulate it.
Ah,
right.
You see? And regulation started out, I mean, you know, this is fairly common knowledge, back during the Roosevelt era,
mm-hmm.
because companies wanted it because people didn't trust their products.
Okay.
For example, meat mm-hmm. was a real big one, especially when hamburger was introduced.
Mm-hmm.
People were just scared to death of it.
Hmm.
And the confidence that they got through the Department of Agriculture and the Food and Drug Administration really helped those industries.
How interesting.
And same thing, too, when you're something that you're heavily involved in, Bill, is workers' compensation. Now, I've read the history about that, and that was something that companies wanted. Because
really?
The only remedy before that was always a lawsuit.
Okay.
And so they were constantly fighting lawsuits, and they were behind workers' compensation. I mean, a lot of companies, I guess, were.
Okay. But isn't the case that most of the time when somebody has a workers' comp claim, a workers' compensation claim, that they always have to go through an attorney anyway? They don't have to, but if somebody should do that?
Yes. I mean, like if I went to a jewelry store to pick out a diamond for my wife, Frances,
mm-hmm.
I would look at that diamond and I couldn't tell that from a fake diamond. So you got to know what the value is, and usually the lawyer's the one who can give you what the value of your claim is. So sometimes folks come to us and just say, this is the offer we got, and we can, you know, say, that's a good offer, you should take it, or we mm-hmm. say, you know, we could do better for you.
Okay, all right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, I had, in my whole career as a union carpenter, mainly working on commercial projects, I only had one injury where I was off and had to collect a workman's comp. That's quite an educational experience. I mean, it's like, you know, I called my business, I tried to just deal with the company, first of all, And they kept, the secretary kept telling me the superintendent was busy. The superintendent was busy. This went on for 4 days. And finally, I started realizing I'm getting the blow off here because the accident happened on Monday.
Yeah.
And so I called my union business agent, and he says, well, let me ask you this. Do you want to get your money, your workman comp checks soon, or do you want to wait possibly a year or more? Mm-hmm. And I said, what? Well, of course I do. He goes, well, then you need to call an attorney.
Yeah, yeah.
And I called the attorney he recommended. The attorney came out that evening, had me fill out some paperwork from the Illinois Industrial Commission and some other paperwork. And I got my first comp checked the middle of the following week. Yeah. I mean, it was that quick.
Yeah. You guys have a lot of good work comp lawyers here in the Champaign-Urbana area. But the thing the lawyer can do is, if it's going to be a contested claim, he can find the witnesses, get the statements. Now, not a year or two later when maybe the folks have moved away, and he can help you with developing the medical evidence that is necessary to win your case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you mentioned, most working people, they think fair-minded, let's put it this way. That this is how it should be, but that's not how, unfortunately, corporate America and the world works. Because my statement to the business agent was, I don't want to sue anybody. I just want to get my comp checks. He goes, well, if you don't get a lawyer, you're not going to get your comp checks.
Right. I tell my people in Decatur that the Andreas family ran ADM for many years, and I said, what do you think Mr. Andreas would do if he or his family got in a wreck? First thing he would do after he found out they were okay is pick up the phone and call who? His lawyer.
That's a good point.
I'm just really glad that unemployment insurance is not done by private companies like workers' compensation. I think that shows you kind of an interesting thing right there. I guess work injuries are profitable, but unemployment isn't. Just think how it would be, what if you had to go get a lawyer to get your unemployment?
Oh, yeah, indeed. So, what are most of your cases, in any given year? As far as, what you usually deal with. You mentioned some earlier. You mentioned, of course, lead poisoning. And, of course, personal injury and stuff.
Right.
And are there any other cases that you do in general? Well,
construction injury cases where workers are hurt and they have both a work comp and maybe what lawyers call a third-party case against maybe the owner of the property. For example, in the ADM facility, since ADM owns the place, if they've hired a subcontractor like Altriar and there's an injury and the Altriar worker is hurt, the worker has both a workers' compensation claim against his employer, Altriar, for example, and he may have what we call a third-party claim against ADM for not providing a safe place because maybe they were in charge of the overall project. So it can get a little complicated.
Now, I heard in the past, anyway, that ADM had a horrible accident.
Oh, man.
Right. Yeah. In fact, what was the nickname for ADM for a while?
I can't remember that. I just remember I was working on this bridge job, and they had a guy there from out of the Decatur local, but he wasn't really from Decatur, and his dad got him on with this company building bridges, which is walking on 8-inch beams over interstates.
Oh, man.
Because he used to work at ADM, and it was too dangerous. It's safer to build bridges over interstates than it is to work at ADM.
Wow.
Well, ADM in the last, I would say, 20 years has really improved its safety record.
Okay.
But initially, it had really smart businessmen like the Andreas family. And their focus was making money and running the operation. And they thought the people they hire should be safe. And, that was a false assumption.
Okay.
Well, Ann Feeney wrote a song about it.
Did she?
Yeah, Deadly Corn.
Deadly Corn?
Yeah, that was about a specific accident. I can't remember the man's name who died there in the 90s.
Okay, all right.
Safety is a sense of awareness.
Mm-hmm.
And if the top management has a sense of safety and an awareness, you're going to have a culture of safety in the organization. But if management is so focused on other things, like they're so busy making money or they got contracts or other jobs to do, and they don't make safety an awareness thing from the top, it's not part of the workers' program. Because the guys will do whatever they can to get the job done quickly and effectively, and safety sometimes is forced to take a back seat unless there's someone there to say, guys, you got to do it safe.
Yes, I think Bill and I can relate to that. We're partially guilty of that. How many jobs have we been on when we didn't wear a safety harness or eyeglasses or,
Well, I drill holes in my hand at home.
Well, I wasn't going to mention that on the air, Bill, but...
I don't ever get workers' comp claims. I always hurt myself at home.
But, well, I guess that's... Well,
but the thing is, a lot of times now, We got them in past years, put all the handrails and everything up, mm-hmm. okay? Now what they're doing is they're getting revenge on us with personal protective equipment.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for example, I was working on a University of Illinois job, hod carrying, that is helping bricklayers, and I had to climb up and down this scaffold all the time and mm-hmm. and stuff, but I never was in a situation where I needed to tie off.
Right.
Okay, but that contractor or the general the construction management company, mm-hmm. who I hope I never work on their projects again, insisted that we had hod carriers had to wear fall protection all the time.
How are you supposed to go and get the mortar? I mean, every time you come to the scaffold, you hook up and then climb up?
No, you just never hooked up. You just had to wear this thing all the time. it's good to have the stuff.
Yeah.
But sometimes they go a little far.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then we won't even get into the drug testing thing. I mean, that's another, when you talked about retaliation, revenge thing, I think that would definitely fit that category, you know.
Well, you know, David, talking about the workplace safety mm-hmm. issues in OSHA, I mean, the OSHA laws are really nice and good mm-hmm. and well written, but there's no one there to enforce them. It's like me driving from Champaign to Decatur and there's a speed limit posted, but there's no cops, so there's no enforcement. You might as well not even have a speed limit. So mm-hmm. without OSHA officials to enforce the rules, it's really not doing what it should be doing.
Yeah, and I've heard that OSHA's been, their funding has been gutted significantly over the years.
And now they allow some corporations to self-report.
That's like the plant explosion out in West Texas.
Oh, yes.
Last year, earlier this year. They said people hadn't been there to inspect it for 10 years or something like that in the last 20 years. And then they split it up between three or four different agencies like that.
Yes. So. You know, we just had a public hearing on fracking rules in our community. It was held this past week. Mm-hmm. And some of the ladies stood up, and they were just so articulate. I was so proud of the citizens of our community talking to those rules guys. But they were saying all these wonderful rules are worthless because the department that will enforce them won't be properly funded. So why are we even bothering?
Who held the hearing, by the way?
It was the Department of Natural Resources.
Okay.
But it wasn't on whether fracking should be done or not. It was on whether the rules they're proposing are worthwhile.
Yeah, really, that's it. That's unfortunate they have this law now. You know, we were actually might have been better off before they passed it and because it's allowing fracking,
mm-hmm.
you see.
And the corporations co-opt everything, and those rules will change over the decades. And so what's there today will be gone tomorrow, and there will be no one there to enforce those rules.
Yeah. Yes, we see this all over the place in this country here. Okay, we're going to take another quick music break, and we'll be right back to finish off the program with Decatur attorney Bill Faber. You're listening to the World Labor Hour on listener-supported community radio station WFT in Champaign, Illinois. Stay tuned.
Some people say a man is made out of mud. Poor man's made out of muscle and blood. Muscle and blood and skin and bone. A mind that's weak and a back that's strong. You load 16 tons, what do you get? Another day older, deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store. I was born one morning, the sun didn't shine. I picked up my shovel and I walked to the mine. Loaded 16 tons, a number 9 coal. And the straw boss said, well, bless my soul. 16 tons, what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store. I was born one morning, it was drizzling rain. A fighting and trouble are my middle name. I was raised in the canebrake by an old mama lion. Ain't no boss man alive, make me walk the line. I load 16 tons, what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store. Thank you. step aside. A lot of men didn't, a lot of men died. One fist of iron and the other steel. If the right one don't get you, then the left one will. You load 16 tons, and what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. Saint Peter, don't you call me, as I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store. To the company store. To the company store. Yeah.
Okay, that was Tom Morello doing a version of 16 Tons. And we're back with the World Labor Hour and Decatur attorney Bill Faber. So, Bill, during the music break, you mentioned that there was some other information you wanted to get across to the listeners about mortgage foreclosure.
Yes. I didn't mention this. This is very important, David, that when a homeowner is working with the bank to try to save the house, mm-hmm. to renegotiate the mortgage, most homeowners feel, well, then if as long as I'm talking, nothing is going to happen legally, even though a complaint for foreclosure may have been filed. Mm-hmm. So the homeowner gets lulled to sleep. But that's not the bank's tactic. The bank takes what we call a two-track approach.
Okay.
They're going to talk, and they're going to litigate at the same time. And the different people in different places are in charge of different tracks. So the right hand does not know what the left hand is doing. The lawyers who are prosecuting the foreclosure for the banks, they want to go ahead because that's how they get paid, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the servicer, the mortgage servicer who's negotiating, they kind of string it out because they kind of get paid. So the thing that a homeowner must understand is that if they're in foreclosure, they're in foreclosure, and they cannot think it's going to go away or hope it will go away. They've got to confront it, and that means you might want to hire a legal counsel.
Okay. Just to share a personal experience, my wife and I, we lost our home in foreclosure in 2010, mm-hmm. and just want to say that in Illinois anyway, it takes once you stop making payments to the bank, it takes about 1 year. It was exactly 12 months from the time that we couldn't make a payment anymore to the time that the sheriff's sale occurred, and then we had they could have issued a 30-day notice for us to move out. I believe it is 30 days.
Yes.
Yeah. But just a little more of that story. The guy that bought the house, the sheriff's sale, was a real decent human being. He spoiled some of our plans for occupying the house and everything. But he basically said to us, take as long as you need to, 2-3 months. I had this happen to me 10 years ago, and I know how it is. And it's
yes.
just like, well, that's a rare individual. But I wanted to get that out so people know that, because a lot of people think that the month they stop making their payment to the bank, that it only be like being evicted from an apartment. It'll
sure.
only be 30 days.
Sure. You can string it out a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
We have the pleasure of representing a World War II veteran who's 94 years old, built the house himself, lives there alone with his puppy dog, Festus, and we've been able to wrangle with the bank and keep them in there for the past 4 or 5 years.
Oh, my gosh. Wow. That's yeah. fantastic.
Yeah. Well, okay. I mean, that can be done. That's kind of the last approach, tactic, but, mm-hmm. There are things that lawyers can do to keep things going.
Great, great. Okay, we just got a few we got about 5 minutes left here, and in that time, I want to talk about your public access television show, The Faber Files. What have you been doing with the, what kind of programs have you been having on The Faber Files?
Well, David, it's a public access program, half-hour interview program, maybe styled along the lines of Charlie Rose. We
okay.
sit there at a table with a black background, and we interview people mm-hmm. about our community, things
okay.
that are happening, issues and interests.
Mm-hmm.
We have a chance to interview the political candidates. We've interviewed David Green, mm-hmm. George Gallin, Ann Callis is scheduled to be on. We're the only show that has a television interview with our local candidates for city council, school mm-hmm. board, etc.
Okay.
Because those people are just shut out, and the electorate right. never gets a chance to meet them. And television is the best and most powerful way because people can see the candidate
yes.
physically and make an assessment of who
these
people.
You mean WAND isn't adequately serving the community, my former place of employment?
You know, the interesting thing is that, that people really think WAND, which is the local, is it NBC affiliate,
yeah,
is a locally owned company. They're out of, like, Toledo, Ohio.
Are you kidding?
A corporation that has nothing to do with our community. And the most popular radio station in our community is not a locally owned station either. So the people have no understanding of that.
Correct. Yeah, I also noticed too. It seems like there's a conservative talk FM station over in Decatur that came on about a year ago.
Yes,
which I find to be really annoying. And it's just like, but Decatur has always been this blue collar union town.
Yes,
and the only talk radio show or station is FM conservative.
Yes, yeah. It's,
and there, of course, there's no left wing stations or liberal, I'll put, stations in Champaign either.
You know, if liberal talk sold ads, we would have liberal talk. And so what sells ads is conservative talk, and that's what the corporate owners have figured out.
Well, okay, just a little bit on that, though. I don't think it's so much selling ads. I think any talk would sell ads. But you might as well sell ads with the talk that supports your corporate ideology,
right,
too.
Right. That's very true. You know, a mutual friend of ours, Bill Eric Sizemore, said that he was in debate with his, you know, somewhat conservative slash right-wing father about Rush Limbaugh. And he said, well, his father said, well, if the people didn't like it, it wouldn't be on the air. And Eric pointed out, well, it's not so, they don't care what the people want to hear. They basically are concerned with what their corporate advertisers want to hear.
Well, it's Rush Limbaugh, when he started out, he lowballed that show and got it on a whole bunch of stations. And then things started happening. I remember the first time I ever heard it on WLS. I was like amazed,
to say the least.
That's I had something else there.
Well, you know, the Rush Limbaugh type or prototype came into existence when the fair opinion rule went out, where you had to present both sides. So that just allowed one side to speak for 3 hours before they had some regulations.
What was that called, Bill? Oh, gosh, I can't believe I can't think of it either. You always, when a station made an opinion, I know the local television station had to say, if somebody challenged it, they had to give them 5 minutes on the air at the end of the news segment of whenever that was, you know, 10 o'clock, 6 o'clock, whatever.
So when that rule went away, that opened the doors to the talk radio.
The fairness doctrine.
The fairness doctrine.
It wasn't really a law. It was an FCC thing. And actually, when you go back in the history of talk radio, like back to the 70s and 60s, it was the liberal side that was the popular side, you know, and then you had the big backlash of the 80s, the loss of the fairness doctrine, where WLS could just run only right-wing people, and that's it's this culture thing that I'm harping on, man. You can't change the politics or the economics unless you change the culture. That's why I am so glad about this uproar of Duck Dynasty. Because they are somewhat presented as sort of like blue-collar people, even though they're wealthy.
Yeah.
You know?
I heard even the beards are fake.
They didn't grow them until later. There's a bunch of pictures on the internet of these, of at least the kids, not the old man, but they all look like yuppies.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
Family pictures.
Well, Bill, thank you so much for coming on the World Labor Hour and continued, you know, fighting the good fight for working people in your law practice, and also, you know, with presenting needful information through the Faber Files television program.
You're welcome. The working families in Decatur really admire the work you guys do.
Okay. Well, that's great. We love to hear statements like that. So, anyway, we're going to end here a little with.